ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Trust in the media isn't what it used to be.
Why the mainstream media isn't reporting this, I do not know. But this is huge.
Sometimes it feels like no one can even agree on what's true anymore.
I don't trust the general public's ability to identify fake news.
So when anything can be faked, how do you keep your bearings? I'm Matt Bevan, and on my show, if you're listening, we sift the fact from the fiction. New episodes on ABC Listen every Tuesday and Thursday.
Today, the Australian people have voted for Australian values.
The choice is simple for the Liberal Party. Change or die.
We need to have more Australian everything. We need to manifest a hyper-Australia.
We've always been about the planet, but we've got to make sure that people have their daily needs met.
People are starting to see that there is actually a different way of doing politics.
Hello and welcome to The Party Room. I'm Patricia Carvallis and I'm joining you from Wurundjeri country in Melbourne.
And I'm Fran Kelly on the Gadigal land of the Eora Nation here in Sydney.
Sydney. I enjoyed being in Sydney this week, in fact, Fran. Back in Melbourne, I won't lie, the weather is miserable. But we're here for question time, but we've dabbled in a question time this week, haven't we?
We did, because we had a live podcast. If you missed it, check it out. It's up. It's there on the stream, celebrating 10 years of this podcast, The Party Room, with a whole bunch of party roomers in person. That was a lot of fun. And I'm still really, you know, chuffed that we've got this 10-year anniversary PK between us. I mean, it's a big thing. And I just want to say a huge thanks to all those who came out for the live party room. A huge thanks to all those who helped us put it together. And yeah, just a huge thanks to you, PK, for being here every Thursday for 10 years.
I know. It's a bit of an innings, isn't it?
So it is.
A few people have actually stopped me and said, you know, that's quite significant. And I'm like, yeah, it is significant. You know, when you're kind of like just living your life, doing your job. And you love it and you don't, it just sort of happens. And
yeah.
Then all of a sudden you're like, oh, milestone. I think it's the thing
exactly
with
right. Milestone.
Yeah.
Look, PK, we've got a whole heap of fabulous questions from our party roomers, and we got some fabulous ones at the party room live the other night. I must say, congratulations, all of you. You're so smart. But before we get to them, just a quick update on some of the big political moves this week, because pre-budget week, and there has been quite a lot. The messaging from the government, yeah, it's been all about the budget. It's a lot about fuel security in particular. And we're recording this on the Friday morning. And this morning, the Finance Minister, Katie Gallagher, and the Treasurer, Jim Chalmers, were up. I'm guessing, PK, see what you think about this, but my antenna were twitching, trying to reset the agenda. They unveiled $64 billion in reprioritisations and savings that will be announced in the budget on Tuesday night. Most of them we know, but what they're saying is this big figure, and it is big, the net savings figure is bigger than those that have come before, and, you know, we'll find out. More to come on the night, but some of them are huge numbers, like the $35 billion in saving already announced in redefining the NDIS, for instance, and the growth figure for the NDIS, $2.7 billion from public sector cuts. That's going to be a talking point for sure. And Katie Gallagher was, you know, at pains to try and say that she's not slashing the public sector. This is normal kind of savings and tightenings and efficiencies and all of that, but it's a big figure. So, yeah, that's come out today. Why was the government trying to say, hey, look here, not there? I think it's, PK, because the so-called ISIS bride cohort arrived in Australia this week, some of them. There was absolute chaos at Melbourne and Sydney airports as the media gathered to meet them. There's been a lot of political argy-bargy ahead of this. The AFP were there. They arrested three women. The AFP boss said foreshadowed that they would be doing this. And, you know, that story really has not just stolen some of the pre-budget spotlight, it's caused real trouble and strife politically for the government, hasn't it?
That it absolutely has. And this is not a story that the government wanted on the eve of a budget where it wants to really herald that it's a big reforming government doing all these big things. However, they also did not create this situation. Governments successive have had to deal with what is a very, very ugly chapter, I think, in the history of these people and what they've done and the consequences because they're Australian citizens. So, you know, the Morrison government had to deal with the fallout too. This is not of their making. However, being in power, it means it is of their responsibility now because that's how it works. That's the system. So three women were arrested on arrival. One woman in Sydney charged with terror-related offences. Katie Gallagher was out today trying to talk, as you were saying, about the budget savings and the sort of reforms and all of the stuff the government wants to be talking about. Of course, she was asked, rightly so, questions about the ISIS brides. And she said that the government had done the right thing. They've been briefed. They're closely following advice, that we have to trust the agencies. It's all being managed very closely. The opposition's making an argument, I think, that probably would resonate with lots of people. It's a very populist argument. You can understand how it's an easy one to make as well. They're talking about the price tag associated with the return of these women and children. Monitoring and counterterrorism is super expensive, and it's true. I mean, what they're saying is demonstrably true. $2 million a person it could cost up to if you do that really intensive monitoring, which, of course, they will have to do for those who are not able to go through a criminal justice system and find their way. You know, if they don't end up in jail, they'll be monitored, if I can be blunt, right? That's the point. And then, of course, the kids have lived in unthinkable conditions and witnessed unthinkable things and been subjected to the most hideous of ideologies. And so these children will now have to be mainstreamed in Australian values, in a liberal democracy, in a place where we have lots of people with different ideas and we have sort of common values. And that's not easy either. Now, the big point the opposition's making is that the government made it too easy to get here. I think that's very contestable. I do think there is evidence that the government has not, I don't see clear evidence yet, that the government has, like, you know, put on the sort of red carpet for them to get here. However, they have got here because they're Australian citizens and they are using that citizenship, aren't they, to its full extent. And now we have to deal with the consequences.
And we have to, and governments have to deal with things as they arise. And this has arisen. These people have come home, as is their right, their citizenship right. The government's made it clear they weren't facilitating this. They didn't really want this to happen. They couldn't have been clearer. And I think the Australian community is split on this. I wouldn't say it's a 50-50 split. I think a lot of people have very little sympathy for the so-called ISIS brides and their kids. But, you know, other people think, well, these are children. These are Australian citizens. They'll come home. We'll deal with them. This is what the United States has been pressuring Australia to do. It's what Syria has been pressuring Australia and other countries who have their citizens still stuck in these camps have been pressuring Australia and others to do, because it's our responsibility. And yes, that has a price tag. Security has a price tag. I think in a sense it's a cheap shot the opposition is making about the cost of it, because at the same time they're saying, well, we have to make sure when these people come home they are closely monitored, and, you know, the AFP is making clear that's what they'll be doing. They have come home. Three have been arrested, as you said, and as the AFP commissioner said they would. They've been charged with crimes against humanity, two of them, for enslavement. These are serious crimes, potentially with major jail terms attached, something like 25 years. I think it's probably helpful for the government, and a lot of people would be relieved that some charges have been laid, because it means the police are onto this, the security forces are onto this, they've assessed, they've realised that they're telling us these people have done things that are in breach of our law, and we will throw the book at them. And the others, well, I guess that means people can, in a sense, relax a little, particularly around the kids being rehabilitated. They're not seen by the security forces as posing such a threat. So I think that makes it clearer for the government to manage. I think it makes it clearer for the community to process. The opposition will keep going on this, but I reckon the government's line, which is, well, our security forces will do we will allow them and enable them and fund them to do whatever they think is necessary to keep Australians safe. And I think that's a powerful line.
It is a powerful line. And, you know, this is genuinely a wicked problem. But, yeah, I think we all know that the kids, you know, you don't get to decide who your parents are, do you? So that is a truism for everyone. And they are the victims here of very bad choices, and hopefully they can be reintegrated as well. Fran, should we get to question time?
Let's do it.
We shall move to questions without notice. Are there any questions? I'll give the call to the Honourable, the Leader of the Opposition.
Yeah. Prime Minister.
The bells are ringing. It means it's time for question time. And Fran, we had a lot of messages to the Party Room and the Politics Now inbox about RAF. And we had a conversation on, I think, the Tuesday pod about whether or not politicians, as I framed it, should be radically honest with regards to policies they already want to introduce before elections or ideas they have. This was in relation, of course, to property taxes and Labor shutting down any idea that they would touch such a thing, even though for a long time, in fact, as we said in the live Party Room, since 2016, Labor first proposed some of these ideas. Clearly, they've thought about it a whole lot for a long time. Raf and I had a range of thoughts and feelings. Special shout out to everyone else who messaged their considered takes. Thank you very much, you all. And to Jersey, who came along to our live show, but we could only pick one. So let's hear from Jack.
Hi, Fran and PK. Jack here from the Central Coast. Love the recent PK and Raf episode on political honesty and trust. As a swing voter, I don't think changing your mind mid-term is automatically dishonest. Sometimes it's the most trustworthy thing a government can do, if they openly explain what changed and why. I trust politicians more if they said plainly, we got this wrong, then showed the evidence and fixed it. What kills trust isn't a genuine change of course, it's serial backflips that look like panic, politics, or no plan. My hot take, we should judge honesty less by never changing position and by transparency when circumstances or evidence does change. Love the pod.
Thank you for that, what I think is pretty thoughtful and nuanced take on trust and at the evolving of views. To everyone else who messaged their considered takes, thank you very much. This one was a bit of a lightning rod debate because I think it's one we're having in the community all the time, right? At different levels based on your engagement in politics, you know, when is truth not truth, you know, like what can the public handle? Are we in a world of short attention spans where politicians, you know, they'd love nuance? As if they don't want to do nuance. Some of them would love to do nuance, but they feel like they can't land nuance, and that's why you see these sharp edges, Fran. What's your take?
Well, I missed the chat with you and Raf, so I'm not sure where you came down on this, but I think I've said it before on this podcast. I think, you know, just glibly criticising politicians for backflips and backdowns is not nuanced and is not where we want our political leadership to be pinned, if you know what I mean. I think when times change, sometimes policies need to change, and that may mean a requirement to break a promise. Now, I think the issue with the capital gains tax and the negative gearing tax is we're only a year on from the election campaign where the Prime Minister said a number of times, no, we won't change those taxes. And I think I'd said a number of times on the podcast that, you know, the government's going to have to look at these things because intergenerational inequity needs to be addressed. Ken Henry, former head of Treasury, has said it louder than most. It's a tragedy, and others have called it theft. Governments need to do something. We've got a housing crisis that is building in this inequity, but it's not just housing. It's a lot of things. And these taxes are a signal that there's, you know, a built-in imbalance now in our housing market and our investment market. And we've had those statistics from Casey, wasn't it, the other day. The statistics are clear that the older generations of Australians have built up all this wealth and all this investment property, and younger Australians have been going the opposite way because they don't have the means and they don't have the opportunity. Something needs to change. I think the government's right to change these taxes. I've been saying that for a lot of years, I think since 2019, that the case has been made, really, that so much money from our federal budget goes to these tax breaks, and maybe that money can be better fairly distributed. So I agree. I completely agree here with Jack that I don't think changing your mind, as Jack said, midterm is automatically dishonest. I think sometimes it's the smartest, the best thing to do when war intervenes, when crises within our society become clear, governments need to take the hard decisions. And sometimes that hard decision is to weather the storm of breaking a promise.
Yeah. Look, Fran, it's worth listening for those who haven't heard it yet to the debate, because I'm not going to land the same points as how boring. Why repeat yourself? But I do think there has to be, and I said that in the pod, room for people to evolve. My issue is when people are not actually really evolving, they already think something and they just don't want to tell you yet because they worry
about
the political consequences.
But you can think something but still think you can't manage to do it.
But no. Oh, no, I'm having the fight again.
Oh, no, we're in the fight
not
again.
Not when you
okay.
are not, because you are being tricky because you think people won't vote for you, Fran.
Come on.
It's
tricky,
a
is
democracy.
It?
You cannot. Let's park it because I'm going to repeat myself and it's so boring to hear me twice. Let's hear this instead. Kate has a great question.
Hi, Fran. Hi, PK. I'm really confused. Can you please explain to me how us taxing multinationals or local companies who are producing the gas on their profits affects our relationships with overseas countries whom we want to import fossil fuel from? It doesn't change the price that they're buying our gas from. So I just don't quite understand this argument. Love some info. Thank you.
Fran, you've been researching this, haven't you?
I have been a little researching it because I haven't been on this topic all week. I've had a range of other things. But I went and looked because the whole thing is our Prime Minister's been moving around the region during this fuel crisis, trying to make sure that our partners will keep sending us the fuel that we traditionally buy from them and we rely on because we need that. And the argument has been, we're selling you gas and we're going to keep doing that. We're a reliable partner and you need to be reliable with the oil imports that we need here and the gas and the fuel imports that we need here. So that's been the deal. And the Prime Minister said, so I'm not going to jump on a fuel tax, a gas tax, because that would be a breach of trust. That would be a sovereign risk, effectively. Why does he think that? Why would the countries in our region that buy our gas, why would they care? Well, I was reminded that the outgoing Japanese ambassador had made it very clear a few months ago that Japan didn't like this idea. He described it would be a bad surprise. And I love this quote. He said, Japan is one of the largest purchasers of Australian gas, right? He said, in the Japanese business dictionary, there's no word called good surprise. Surprise in the Japanese business dictionary is always bad. So at a simple level, our customers just don't want to see anything that might disrupt the gas contracts they've got with Australia. So if those selling us the gas suddenly have a big tax whacked on them, maybe they'll want to jump up the price.
That's the thing though. It's not going to be whacked on them. It's on the gas companies. And then they're worried about...
No, that's right. So yeah. Maybe the suppliers will then whack up need to say, well, we need to whack up the price even though we've contracted it, we're selling to you. So they don't want any bad surprise. They don't want any intervention in this market. And because our government has been so sort of cap in hand saying, make sure you keep sending us the fuel sources we need during this crisis, they don't want to disrupt that apple cart. But, PK, as we've said before and as you've been pointing out quite clearly, the Prime Minister has ruled it out for now during this war, but not necessarily for all time. Is that what you think?
Yeah, and I see, actually, this is beautiful the way you said that, because I can now make a perfect segue to the point that I said was be repetitive, but it's actually linked to this. So I reckon the way he's dealt with this is better than he's dealt with some of the other things. Now, it's because we're not in an election that he can be a little more honest, but the fact that he's just promised that he won't whack on a gas export tax to existing contracts.
And that's the word, right? Existing.
Existing contracts. That's pretty upfront. He didn't say forever. He didn't say it's not a watching brief, but right now doesn't think it's the right time, wants stability. I think he's made those arguments actually really well. So yeah. I see that as a little more honest. Like now some people would say, oh, yeah, but he still like sounds like he's, you know, that line that the sort of people who are for this are arguing at the moment. They're saying, oh, well, you know, it's the talking points of the gas companies. Well, some of them sound familiar. Yeah, I can see.
Well, the gas
see.
Companies don't want surprises either.
Yeah.
And they don't want, surprise, surprise, to have to pay more tax on their profits. But This is, and I made this point in the Party Room Live, this is an idea that's been around since the Henry tax review many years ago, and a super profits tax was around then. Labor tried it at the time. It didn't work. They got hammered. They've been gun shy ever since. And the companies have won that argument. But now there is this head of steam for, at a time when gas companies are making big profits at the moment, that that the Australian people should benefit from that because it's our resources, even though the argument from the companies is, well, yeah, it's your resources, but unless we spend billions to get it out of the ground, you're getting nothing. So, you know, it's just an argument about tax.
It is. And I suppose the counter to that is, if not now, then when does it sort of go off the boil? Well, it definitely means it's going to be delayed significantly. And again, it takes me back to capital gains and negative gearing that I think we'll see on Tuesday, all but confirmed really. And the reforms, don't know the form they'll take, but that will happen there. That conversation started in earnest in 2016. We're in 2026, it finally happens. Is that what happens with the gas export tax, you know? And who knows who's in government in 10 years? That's a long time.
I don't think it'll take 10 years. I think the head of steam within the community is really quite strong now. And I think once the war is over and, you know, fuel prices come down, well, it'll depend if that coalition of clamour for the gas tax continues. You know, at the moment it's led by the Greens and some of the independents. David Pocock is red hot on this, some of the other independents. And there is a kind of a community coalition around it. Yeah, but you're right. It depends how sort of willing that remains.
And the other part of this, of course, is that the government has opened a front, if you like, a policy area in relation to a gas reservation policy. So we had...
This is a whole new thing, right?
It's a whole new thing, and it's obviously different to a gas export tax, but it is going to have a big impact on gas exporters, because that's what it's about. So now they've announced what is really a policy to force the gas giants to set aside 20% of their gas for the Australian market that they would otherwise be exporting.
It's called an East Coast Gas Reservation Policy, and they hinted at it before Christmas, didn't they, PK?
They did, and now they've kind of announced it. There's still a lot of detail to be nutted out, actually, Fran. They say, however, that it'll be a modest oversupply. So what does that mean? They say modest. Others would say maybe it'll be more. Let's see with the detail what modest actually means in practice. But if you've got more gas that you're putting in the system, basic economics tells you more gas, prices go down. Right?
And also, I mean, importantly with this, the fact that it's called a gas reservation policy, it's decoupling the Australian domestic gas price with the international gas price. At the moment, Australia is the number two gas exporter, I think, behind the US. We export a hell of a lot of gas. We export all the gas, basically, which means industries wanting to buy it here have to buy it on that international market, on that global market at a global price. So this is decoupling the domestic price, and it means that the market here will be setting the price within that gas reserve. So that hopefully will bring the price down. I'm sure it will bring the price down. And certainly industry is really happy about this, not the gas industry, but the manufacturers and those who are buying the gas and relying on the gas.
Yeah. And the problem for the government still, though, until they nut out the details, is I asked Madeleine King, the resources minister, who I had on afternoon briefing, you know, how much will it take down prices? What is the modelling? What does it show? They can't answer any of that other than...
No, it sounded bad. I mean, Mel Clark really pressed Tim Ayres on it this morning and he had nothing.
Yeah.
They don't know
the answer, genuinely, but... No.
Which begs the question, why have they announced it now?
Well...
Like this.
Yeah, because have you noticed how much they're announcing? There's only one message coming out of this government. We're a government of action this year. And I think that they're actually landing that well. I think the politics is good. I think they're doing politics a whole lot better. I'm not, you know, I'm not going to laud the detail, though, because I can't see it yet. But the politics, I think they're doing a much better job of. Our next question comes from Hamish.
Hi, PK and Fran. Hamish again from Nipaluna, Hobart. My question this time is around the budget. Are people usually this excited for budgets, or is this a one-off? I'm really intrigued.
Another perfect segue.
Okay.
Are you usually this excited, PK, by
I'm excited about, as my partner says, like the opening of a can. Like
you're
excited. I'm excited about most things, right? Like I just was born excited. That's how I live. Okay. However, are we excited? Look, the truth is we get excited about budgets every year. They're a set piece for a government. They tell you the government's priorities. The government has to do some difficult things too. That also tells you a story of what they're prepared to do or what they're prepared to burn capital on or not burn some of, you know, where they're at politically. So that's my lens often, you know, 94 seats. How much are they willing to gamble with that majority? Because you cannot do controversial things without pissing people off. It is just the truism of politics. So how far are they willing to antagonise? Because you have to antagonise, whether it be the property owners or the richer boomers. Did you like how I did that? Boomers are not one group. The richer
boomers.
No, that's
important. That's a really important point.
Call them the richer boomers.
Yeah.
Because I know many, I do know poor boomers, and it's like hard as you get older, right? So I think there is, however, a bit more excitement about this one. Wouldn't quite call it a one-off, Hamish, not a one-off, but a bit more, I'll say, just like a 10% more, because the government themselves have told us this will be their biggest reforming budget, they themselves. So they've actually set us themselves a very large test, and that makes it very interesting. Now, in terms of media management, my last point, before I throw it to you, I think you'll notice a few people have said there's nothing left to announce. And I've even had Labor people say that to me who know the budget, who go, really, honestly, there's a lot that's been we've put out there, which I think is interesting because and smart because why burn everything in one day? You know, just really tell a longer story, which is what they've done in the sort of getting to budget day. So smart. Don't do it all at once. It's too much. People can't consume that kind of information either. But I still think there'll be surprises. I don't know. I mean, Chalmers surprised everyone last year. I suspect there'll be more. Don't know what it is, or it wouldn't be a surprise.
I can't remember the surprise last year, but
it was the tax cut.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the tax cut.
Come on, the opposition came out and said they weren't going to support it.
That's true.
I think that was a pivotal moment.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, this has been happening more and more. I mean, 10 years ago, when I used to come on and do post-budget chats with you on R&D Drive, you know, I'd come, you'd say, what was the rabbit out of the hat this time, Fran? And there was always something, but less and less and less, right? So this is a strategy that's been bedded down. Yes, there's been really big things. They've got the bad news out, right? That $64 billion in savings, aka cuts. Or limits, that's out. And what they don't want is, if it was all there on budget night, guess what the headlines would be? It'd be the bad news. So are they holding something back? Yes, there will be something. We don't, the Prime Minister has said, look, yes, yes, there is talk about capital gains tax, negative gearing. Some of it's right, not all of it's right. So we don't know some of the details. So I think there'll be stuff there. But why are we more excited about it? I think PK's right, because we haven't had a government with such a large majority for a long time. So how much capital will they burn? They're promising a reform government. I think they're doing that, PK, not to set the bar, but to sort of make us all think, oh, it's a reform budget, because they've been so criticised for doing little reform. This Prime Minister has showed a penchant for caution. How much are they going to throw off those shackles this time? I think there's a lot of interest because cost of living is terrible. People really want help. They want something from the government to signal that if you're not going to give me a handout, which I don't think they are going to give much handout, you know, are you going to do something to make this Australian economy better?
Mm-hmm.
And are you going to kickstart it somehow so we're all going to be better off? I think there's a bit of expectation and need and wishing and hoping around that from people that might be a little bit more interested in a budget this time than they usually are. That's my sense of it.
Yeah, I think that's a perfect way of describing it. Our next question comes from Steph.
Hi, PK and Fran. It's Steph here from Melbourne. I was in Blairgowrie, Victoria, over the weekend, where there's a Nepean state by-election. And I saw a poster out front of a voting booth that said, a vote for One Nation is a win for Jacinta Allen in November. And I was confused by that because it was an ad run by the Liberal Party. At the same time, the Libs are preferencing One Nation themselves in Farrer. So I don't really get what the Liberal Party strategy is with One Nation. I would love to know more if you can shed some light on this ad and what's going on. Thanks.
That's a good question. What is the Liberal Party strategy with One Nation? Look, we're recording this just before the Farah by-election, and I'm going to give another plug to our coverage on the television tomorrow night because we're working hard to tell you what's happening in this by-election. Of course, Susan Lee resigning from the parliament, opening up this contest that's become really a contest in the bizarrest of worlds between One Nation and the Independent, with the Nationals and the Liberals barely getting a mention sometimes, and then Labor not even contesting it, which is, you know, whatever, it's never a Labor seat. So, yeah, what is their strategy? Well, I think they haven't landed on one yet. I mean, if you look at some people, I'll give you two names, Garth Hamilton and Andrew Hastie, they go pretty hard on One Nation. Then you've got a more muted version from others. Then you've got them preferencing One Nation. Then you've got argy-bargy between One Nation volunteer and a senior frontbencher in James Patterson. They're at sixes and sevens about how to deal with One Nation. They want them to go away, but they're not going away. They don't want to insult right-wing voters, so they're trying to give them preferences to show that they're not, you know, that they are aligned with their broader right-wing politics, but that's, of course, going to alienate them in the cities. It's a hot mess.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, the preference swap, the Liberals giving their preferences to One Nation, that's a signal, right? That's a signal that, hey, we are more simpatico with this group of right-wing politicians than we are with the Teals, okay? So that's to their base. But the other part of it is that the Liberals desperately need to shore up their primary vote, okay? So, yeah, they're preferencing One Nation, but they want, they're begging people for the primary vote. I mean, Angus Taylor said the other day about the Farah by-election, if the vote sprays, Labor stays. This will be their message up to the next federal election because, yeah, sure, they're going to preference them, but they want their Liberal, their primary vote to go up because otherwise they look like losers. They look like a spent force. So I think they're desperately trying to persuade as many people as possible to give the coalition their primary vote. But at the same time, yeah, but if you don't, okay, we can work with this other lot. We'll give them their preference because we can work with them, and that's really what you want to hear.
Yeah. And then we're going to see exactly what how happens. That all lands for an electorate, because it's not my favourite thing, can I say, about elections is as much as I write about polls, and I do often in my column, I think polling gives you an indication, there is nothing like an actual election where all of the things people are hypothesising and making things up about or analysing based on anecdotes and focus groups and one random survey is tested in preferential, real compulsory voting. So we will know how the people of Farah feel, and we will know what that might mean for the rest of the country. We'll get an idea anyway, and I can't wait. Well, that's it for the Party Room for today. It's not just our birthday week, although 10 years, nothing to scoff at. Double digits, you know, we're not in the one digit area anymore. Double digits. It's also David Attenborough's, and that's a triple digit.
Yeah, that's big, right? That's big. We hit double digits, he hit triple. And if you love David Attenborough, let me just tell you this, on the Radio National Hour tonight, I'm speaking to an Australian ecologist who was inspired to study nature and ecology and biology because of his love for David Attenborough. And then later in life, he also studied film production, and he got to spend 20 years of his life out in the field making David Attenborough's documentaries, filming them, producing them, scripting them. He's got a lot to say, all pretty much loving, really, about David Attenborough. And if you want to hear that, it's going to be a great chat tonight on the Radio National Hour.
Oh, absolutely. So, and also then, of course, online, if you somehow listen to this after the tonight happens, because we're recording this on a Friday, always here to help, Fran.
Thanks. Wherever you get your podcasts, just check out the Radio National Hour.
The Kelly content. That's what I'm here for. I'm a I'm the advertising budget for the Kelly content.
That's
Can
it.
Can I say?
That's about true, actually.
Yeah, it is actually sadly true. David Spears will be back for Insiders on Background, and all of that stuff we usually do. One more thing, politics now on Monday, setting up a big week, and next week is budget week. I will be there for the budget, of course, because that's what
you're gonna
I do
be everywhere. Tune in tomorrow night, with PK, David Spears and Casey on the Farah by-election, and then, of course, Budget Week on Tuesday. So much going on. Too much politics is never enough.
See you, Fran.
See you, PK.